Greetings and welcome to TIU Radio, theinfounderground.com. Today's date is Thursday, 30th of April in the year 2009. I'm your host, Ogner. Welcome to the show. I have a guest coming up, a very, very interesting guest, just waiting on this a six-term congresswoman to call me back here, and we'll get this interview going, so we'll be back shortly. And we are joined on the line by six-term congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. Cynthia, welcome to the show. Thank you for allowing us some of your very precious time.
Well, thank you very much. You've managed to find me as I've tucked myself away in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. So I'm actually talking to you today from Haiti.
Perfect. Well, and what is your connection to Haiti?
Well, I actually came here with the objective in mind of escaping from people like you who want to take up my time so I could actually write a book. And notwithstanding that, I've been found. So I don't think there's a single spot on this planet that I could go to and someone not recognize me or me not be found. So I'm actually happy to have been found, and I'm in the final stages now of my book. So I hope to be able to say mission accomplished once I leave here.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about your book?
Well, it's a series of vignettes. It's not really, you know, an autobiographical tome, but it's a very short little, hopefully uplifting book that chronicles a few of my experiences while I was in and out of Congress and some of the things that actually motivate me to the activism and the public service for which I have become one, renowned in some circles, and two, reviled by other circles.
I'm sure we're going to talk about that. You were a congresswoman from 1993 until 2003, and then again from 2005 to 2007. The first question I'd like to ask you, why, doing some research about yourself and your family, I came across your father, who seemed to have been another prominent activist and a leader in Georgia, and actually you were a father and daughter team, if I believe that's correct. What spurred you to get into politics, and especially what to the reason for going to Washington, D.C.?
Well, I'll tell you that nowhere in my plan was there this idea that I was going to run for office and that I would end up in the United States Congress and trying to do all of the things that I've tried to do in terms of making human rights the center point for U.S. activity abroad and, quite frankly, at home. That wasn't a part of my plan, but I became involved in politics basically at the behest of my father, who actually put my name on the ballot when I was away in Jamaica having a baby. And I didn't even know that he had put my name on the ballot. He was having a little beef with one of his colleagues in the Georgia legislature, and so the way he got back with the colleague was to put me down to run against her. And but it didn't take long for things to go sour for me in Jamaica, and so I came back with nothing but a baby. And I know that many of the women who are listening to this can relate to what my experience was. I got married, I had a baby, the marriage didn't work out so well, and I left my country too, and then I had to come back. And when I came back, I decided, well, you know, my dad had this idea, maybe I'll follow up on it. And I ran for a seat, and against all of the, you know, pundits, I won. And that is what made my father and me the first and only, actually, legislative father-daughter team in the entire United States. We both served in the Georgia House of Representatives. We served together. My father assumed that he had two votes instead of the normal one vote that most members of the legislature have. And as it turned out, he and I disagreed on so many issues that his idea just went up in flames. And then, of course, our disagreements made the newspaper, and we became sort of a cause celeb until I ran afoul of the pro-Israel lobby once I became a member of Congress. And honestly, I was not supposed to win that congressional seat. I won that seat, though, on the fact that my father had been a civil rights stalwart worker, one of the unnamed hundreds of thousands of people who did the work of civil rights in the United States during and before the time of Dr. Martin Luther King, and during that time, and then after that time. And my father was a direct beneficiary of the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In fact, he was there in Selma at the time of the Bloody Sunday. Bloody Sunday was when the blacks were demonstrating for the right to vote in Alabama. The governor at that time, George Wallace, sent out the national members of the National Guard and the local police. They beat up the marchers who were trying to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge going from Selma into Montgomery. It became known as Bloody Sunday as a result of that. And the fact that it was televised and people all over the United States saw what black people were going through in order just to get the right to vote. President Lyndon Johnson was so outraged at what happened that he made a commitment to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that the Congress would pass and he would sign the Voting Rights Act. And when the Voting Rights Act was signed into law, it mandated that certain changes in the administration of elections take place in places like Georgia. And it was at that point, before the signing of the Voting Rights Act, my father had run for office and lost, run for office again and lost. And then when those changes took place, my father ran for office, and he won as a result of a much more level playing field. And that began the McKinney story in Georgia, and that's where my story in Georgia begins as well.
Okay, excellent. I'll get a few new little pieces in there. I heard that your father was a policeman, and he used to actually bring you up on his shoulders, and he'd actually protest outside his own police station. Is that correct?
Yes, you've done quite a bit of research, but yes, he actually did that because, of course, this was during the time of segregation when he became one of the first black police officers in the city of Atlanta. And so that meant that whatever the indignities were that blacks had to endure at that time, then he had to endure them as well, even though he wore the blue uniform. And these little indignities that he had to endure were like, for example, they couldn't change their uniforms from their uniform into the civilian clothes or vice versa at the headquarters of the police department. They had to go down the street around the corner to the black YMCA, and that's where they had to maintain their lockers and change their clothes into and out of their police uniforms. If they happened to see a white person who was inside the city of Atlanta committing a crime, then they couldn't arrest that white person. They had to get on the phone and call a white police officer to come and arrest the white person who's committing the crime. Of course, by that time, that person had long since departed, and so there was a lot of white criminal activity that was not prosecuted. However, this was not a reciprocal relationship. The white police officers could come into the black community at any time and not only arrest blacks who were committing crimes, but they could mess with, harass blacks who were not committing a crime. In fact, they could beat them. And one of the things that my father protested against a lot was that the white police officers would come into the black community. Maybe they were having a bad day or whatever, and they wanted to beat up somebody. So they would find a random black man. They would handcuff him to the telephone pole where the lines, the electricity and the telephone lines were connected, and they would beat him. And this was the kind of thing that happened all the time. My father would come home and he would complain to us. He would complain to my mother, and I would overhear these complaints. And finally he decided, I'm going to protest. And so he protested these things. And every time he protested, somebody else got a promotion. And that was the beginning of my understanding, as I look back on what happened with him, that was the beginning of my understanding of public service with great private sacrifice and service without expectation of reward. So my father basically, through his own behavior and activities, demonstrated what I later became in the Congress that other people to this day. I just opened up an email, and one young man is telling me that now is my time, not me personally, but for people who think like me and believe like me, that now is our time because we're seeing the disintegration of the Republican Party. And for people who understand that neither the Republican Party nor the Democratic Party can deliver to the people that which they need because those parties have been completely taken over by special interests, now is the time for those of us who are not tied to these special interests to step forward. And I began to compose a response to him and say, yes, I understand exactly what you're saying. I understand your analysis. But at the same time, when there is this time, there is also the private sacrifice that people don't know about. And so how long do those public figures sacrifice privately? And if I look back at those people who are my role models, like, for example, Malcolm X, his entire life was private sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And if I look at Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his entire life was private sacrifice. People celebrate Rosa Parks today, but Rosa Parks couldn't get a job in Montgomery after she remained seated on that bus. She couldn't find employment from any of the black institutions in Montgomery who shunned her because of the heat that came down on her because she took a stand, and she had to leave and go to Michigan. And that's where she and her husband relocated because they bore the brand of this retribution on her family because she dared to take a stand. Well, it's no different what happened to them than what happens to me on a daily basis. And I have not talked about it. I've tried to bear it with some measure of grace. But how long do you watch as those who inflict the kind of damage on me personally that they are doing now to my country and to the global community, and they do it with impunity? Absolutely. And so I have a lot of this time that I'm spending in Haiti also is also good for recharging the battery, refocusing, trying to figure out what the next steps are. People are looking to me, expecting a certain measure of leadership from me, and honestly, I do have to take some time and recharge the battery, the ever-ready batteries that, you know, they talk about the bunny that goes on forever, or maybe that's Duracell, I can't remember now, but even they have to be recharged. So this time is not just for book writing, it's also for recharging too, I think.
I think there might be some pent-up resentment to the treatment that you got in Washington, which I want to get on to next. I just want to go back to your during your six terms in the Congress. You changed districts. You went from the 4th to the 11th district. There was gerrymandering going on, which is an illegal issue. Can you give me a little bit of background? I've been doing, I won't say, there's another famous guy that says, I've done the research. I did a little bit of research, Cynthia, on you in preparation for this show. And what I came across is, you weren't just, you mentioned the pro-Israel lobby in Washington, but I'm talking about in your own districts that they resorted to all sorts of different harassments on you. I was reading, let me read this. Now, this I found absolutely horrific statement that was made about you in 2002. I don't know whether you've read this, but let me read it to you. It was going on about when you were a visiting professor at Cornell University. You remember that?
Oh, gosh.
let me read this. I think this is absolutely a shocking statement, but let me read it. At this point, McKinney took a position as the visiting professor at Cornell University. Peter Schwartz said, and I quote, "The selection of Cynthia McKinney as a professor is an affrontment to the intellectualism of Cornell University. Miss McKinney is a racist and an anti-Semite of the first rank. If she were white and a male, she would be David Duke." I mean, that is outrageous. This is, now, I called Washington District of Criminals a viper pit. Now, you've survived, Congresswoman, six terms there. What sort of... Can you give us some detail on, which is quite obvious if you look into it and you have an open mind, that Washington is under a state of, Washington DC is under siege by a very, very, very powerful group. You named the pro-Israel group. Can you give me some more details about the harassment that, over your 12 years that you suffered?
Well, if I were to give an accounting, I think I would use up all of your time that you have allotted. What I'll do is I'll pick one story that could be illustrative of, sort of some of the things that happened. During the 2002 re-election campaign, there was a gentleman who was in my campaign headquarters who gentleman identified himself as an observer, a political observer of our campaign. And he would sit in a rocking chair with my father at the campaign headquarters, and they would share stories about the campaign and, the state of politics and that sort of thing. This gentleman befriended my father.
Okay.
Well, after the election was over and all kinds of things happened, like the loss of the keys to the vans that were going to transport people, the theft of the telephones from the phone banking room that was an off-site place that nobody was supposed to know the location of. This particular gentleman, who had identified himself as a stateless Palestinian, went on the television and announced himself as the Southern Regional Bureau Chief for one of the pro-Israel organizations.
Wow.
And so our campaign was disrupted and totally disrupted, particularly on Election Day, and that was the leak. We didn't know until Election Day, but then we found out when this particular volunteer showed up on television.
Can you put a name to this guy? Is this guy still around?
I don't know if he's still around, but he ended up being a member of the Anti-Defamation League. There are many pro-Israel organizations that have a political impact or conduct political business. And the Anti-Defamation League is one of them.
Okay.
You have the American Israel Public Affairs Committee as another one of them. And those are the among the better known political organizations.
Cindy, I mean, actually, in your day today, during your six terms, how did these people? I mean, you must have had some interaction with AIPAC and these different pro-Israel lobbies. How did that go on? You get memos, emails, facts saying, "Listen, we'd like your support." I mean, obviously, which I'll get onto shortly, is the 9/11 incident. I've also come across in my research that the black or minority congressmen that head to Washington, especially the black congress people, are instantly treated as anti-Semites and are controlled by that. Can you verify that's true?
Well, there's a methodology that is employed that allows one to be categorized with respect to one's affinity for the pro-Israel cause. And so that methodology includes, for example, a statement or a signing of a pledge or a statement being made when you're a candidate for Congress, that you are going to observe certain issues in the Israeli interest. For example, military superiority of Israel, continued economic support from
$30 billion free dollars a year.
Yes, whatever the amount is that is designated by the Israeli interest as to how much they need from the U.S. Treasury for military and economic support. Also, the issue of Tel Aviv as the capital, of Jerusalem as the capital city, is also something that one is asked to.
So you're saying, just to clarify this, you're saying that as you are running for Congress, so you could be, you know, Joe Blow, anybody, you're running for Congress, there is some sort of an agreement, whether it's a written or an understanding, that if you make it to Congress, you will go along with certain pro-Israel policies. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Now,
that's correct.
Congresswoman, you spent many years in Washington. I don't know how you did so. Excuse me. I don't know how you did so long in this pit of vipers. we have an expression out on blogosphere, which is DC is under Zionist occupied government. From what you're saying here, this is just clarifying, and that is this, sadly, that is the state of affair, that politics in Washington DC has more got to do with Israel than it does have to do with the poor American people that are actually suffering now.
Well, one of the things that my father asked when both he and I were under attack, and we honestly had seen little bits here and there, but we had never seen anything like what they exposed themselves to be capable of doing in both of our 2002 campaigns for re-election. And, you know, the sad fact is that my father said, what does Stone Mountain have to do with Israel? But in fact, it had a lot to do with Israel.
I was looking at one of your videos. It was posted up on Daily Motion, which is a French equivalent to YouTube. And you were saying you were talking about 9/11, but one of the things you were saying is why aren't the media asking the right questions or the big questions that need to be asked? I take it for granted that the media and Washington DC are in the pockets of these people. I also believe that in your 2002 campaign that pro-Israel money, pro-Jewish money came from New York to fight against you, and that allowed your opponents to, which was kind of a, from what I'm reading, you know, looking back over blogs that are 5-6 years old, which is kind of quite a surprise that you got beaten by your opponent, 58% to 42%. Is there any truth to that money came in from outside, and specifically from New York, to break up your campaign? I mean, obviously you told us
yes.
That you had a spy in your midst. So you're asserting that money came in from I presume New York, seems to be money headquarters, specifically to get you out of politics. Get you out of Washington, D.C.
Yes, in 2002, I was not the only person who was so targeted. There was another member of Congress from Alabama, Congressman Earl Hilliard. The first time since Reconstruction that a black had been elected to the Congress in Alabama, and issues pertaining to Israel took him out of Congress. And there was a big hue and cry about the way the pro-Israel lobby was able to go into the heart and the soul and the brain, the entire body politic of the black civil rights push for representation, and get completely sideswiped by the pro-Israeli forces operating inside U.S. politics. But that's exactly what happened. Not only in 2002, but it happened to me again in 2006.
How did that work out?
Well, basically, utilizing the same mechanism, the money coming from outside, the hand-picked opponent running inside the primary where it had already been sort of calculated, this is how much you need in order to get rid of her. And the second time around in 2006, what we learned later was that one vote that I represented, when the Democratic leadership was going around recruiting Democrats in order to run with a pro-war bent.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what happened when they were being recruited. They were being recruited for the purpose of voting yes to fund the war. And you can see this written up about, you know, the activities of Rahm Emanuel pulling out all the stops in order to get more conservative Democrats to run for Congress. And then he supported them financially, and then they were able to win. What happened was in 2007, when the new Congress was sworn in and they were called upon to cast the vote for to continue the war, that vote passed exactly with the number of votes required in the House, which is 218. Had I been there, had they not done what they did to me in 2006, I would have been there and cast a no vote. What would that have meant? It meant that there would have been no more funding for the war. So that's how important that seat was, is how important it was for them to get rid of me. That's how important it was for them to make sure that they had a friendly vote there in that seat in order to vote for war.
How many friends do we have in Washington, D.C.? If you were to look around and see some of your politicians around, do we, I'm talking about the people of America, but you know, the people of America are people of the world, which includes me and includes everyone. We watch on to what happens to this viper pit. Do we have many friends in Washington, D.C., actually?
I think the measure should be when one of those resolutions comes up, like, for example, some measure that AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, is pushing. And that generally is going to be some anti-Sudan, anti-Somalia, anti-Iran, anti-Libya, might be an anti-Lebanon piece of legislation. You look and you see who votes yes and who votes no. And then it's very clear who you probably have no more than 3 to 4 to 5 people out of 535 people.
Wow.
Who would be what you would consider putting the U.S. interest first.
1%. 5 out of 5.
If you're lucky.
Wow.
Yeah, 5 out of 535.
Well, you know, I just want to get into a little bit of, Cynthia, that's an absolutely flabbergasting number. The American people have no voice in Washington, D.C. Maybe that's why it's not part of the United States. I want to get into some of, Washington, you were talking about these 99% of the U.S. politicians that are controlled. Now, from my research and learning, a lot of these people have been are controlled because of former misadventures with young boys, and the toilet sex with Larry Craig. We had the Franklin cover up. We had different the Foley incidents, where the instant messaging log was released to the public. This guy is trying to chat up a 15-year-old male. There seems to be a lot of homosexuality, a lot of pedophilia surrounding Washington, D.C. Now, they're the only ones. They're the ones I know of, probably a couple more that I've heard of. Now, I did look into the criminal records of Congress. Beside the DUIs, wife beating, and I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. It really does. Is that only the tip of the iceberg as far as Washington, D.C. goes?
Well, I think you have certain situations that people find themselves in, and it's, you know, sort of very innocent. But these are things that they would rather the public not know. And then there's another kind of situation that people find themselves in because they think that this kind of behavior or this activity is going to ingratiate them with the leadership. And so they find they end up doing things that they would not ordinarily do.
Yeah, I just like, this is important. Can you be a little bit more specific on this point? That they would do things for the leadership.
Well, I would rather not be any more specific. Okay. I mean, but just that this is something that you know, people try to ingratiate themselves with those who can assign them good committees or whatever. And, you know, they think that this is what's going to happen, but in the end, they, you know, don't always get what they expect. And then there is the other situation where, you know, people, it's not so innocent, and people are deliberately entrapped in certain behavior so as to make sure that they
play along.
That they don't become problematic later on. And that's the sort of thing. I mean, I'm sure that we wouldn't know about Monica Lewinsky unless there were people inside the administration who were holdovers from the previous administration and made the whole situation with Monica Lewinsky public. Otherwise, we would not have known. And I'm sure these people had their own reasons for doing so. Or the situation with the previous governor of New York State, for example, who was digging into AIG and
and
Elliot Spitzer, as I'm talking about, and all of a sudden we know everything about him. Or we can look at the Republican who was in Illinois, who was running a Senate race against the now President Barack Obama, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, his divorce records that were sealed become unsealed, and well, they were never legally unsealed. They became public, and so then, of course, there's a sex scandal, and so then he has to drop out of the race. I mean, you know, these are the kinds of things that that happen, and the only reason it didn't happen with me was because I understood from where my father had come from. Cool. You know, he had the FBI wiretapping, and you know, there were things that happened because of my father's activism that we just knew happened. And then, of course, I studied the counterintelligence program to try and understand a little more what was going on and why we were in the situation that we were in. And the counterintelligence program consisted of government efforts to quash dissent, and they focused on certain aspects of the U.S. resistance at the time from 1919 to the present. And these documents are available for people to view on the internet if they put in COINTELPRO. You can see the actual government documents. And so the hounding of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the incitement to murder Malcolm X, the actual activities on the day of Dr. King's assassination. All of this is a part of this story, the targeting of the members of the Black Panther Party, and of course the subsequent murder, the incitement of fratricide inside the Nation of Islam. All of that is there inside these documents written by members of the FBI, the CIA, local law enforcement, and the story is there to tell of what the true cost was that was paid by people who dared to take a stand against the activities, whether it was the Vietnam War or the suppression of of minorities, be they black or Latinos, the Puerto Rican independence movement, the American Indian movement, all of them were targeted for the kinds of things that the senator who exposed this to the public called illegal and un-American.
Absolutely. Let me just get a name here. I have a name, but I'll ask you the question. Who's the most powerful person in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. It's, it depends on what area you're talking about.
No, the overall. I have a name. I have a name of a guy that joined the Army in 1991 during the first Gulf War. I have reviewed several videos where a former PR guy for the Democrats, Dick Morris, said Bill Clinton was only afraid of one guy, and it was this particular guy. He's got dual nationality and dual loyalties, and the name MEGA comes to mind when I talk about this guy, Rahm Emanuel. Now, is there somebody giving more instructions to Rahm Emanuel, or am I completely way off?
I think what you're talking about is basically really who controls the United States government.
Yes.
There are people who are in the front, and the American people go through the exercise of electing their representatives on every level, including congressional and the presidency. But who really calls the shots? And I think one could look at my career, honestly, and say, well, maybe it's not Congress who are making the policy. And you can just look at the moneyed interests, the special interests. And so the interests basically rule. And the people take a back seat to the special interests, and that the job of the two political parties that are captives of the special interests is to trick the people into believing that they represent the values of the various political spectra in the population, when in actuality they don't. And that's why I walked away from the Democratic Party, because it became clear that on issues of torture and war and other issues, the well-being of the people of the United States, the Democratic Party was not going to deliver. And so we've had this now very slick presidential campaign where a lot of money was spent in, television ads and all of the propaganda that goes along with a campaign. But at the end of the day, you've got the Obama administration going to court to defend the rendition, the torture, the wiretapping, the illegal spying on U.S. citizens, and the treatment of those detainees. The Obama administration, the Obama Justice Department, is in court today arguing for the continuation of the Bush policies. And in fact, I was talking to one young lady who is a Haitian American advocate for U.S. policy toward Haiti. And she informed me the other day that actually, Obama is worse today for Haiti, because at least there were no deportations of Haitians. President Bush put a temporary hold on deportations from the United States of people who were inside the United States, sending them back to Haiti. And instead, those deportations have resumed under President Obama. So there were people who expected that we were going to end the war immediately. That hasn't happened. They expected that there was not going to be any torture. That hasn't happened. They expected there would be no more enemy combatants. That hasn't happened. They expected that U.S. Americans would not be subjected to illegal spying. That hasn't happened. They expected that we were going to have a rational healthcare system so that people would be able to be treated for their ailments. That hasn't happened. We still have young people who go to college, and they just to go to college, they end up literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. Nothing has happened with respect to education. There is no livable wage. So what is it that was promised that has been delivered?
Well, I was going to ask
That's
you.
That's what many people are asking.
I was going to ask you, can you give me your definition of the first 100 days of Obama? But I think you've answered that one very clearly. But if you watch European and American media, you think Obama is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I think these important things that are underreported, or you really have to go and look at the question of waterboarding a guy up to 30 times in a single day, and that went on for over a month. Do you think Obama is going to go after some of these criminals I was only following orders, how long can that go on? Or do you think Obama is actually serious and if he's given instructions to go after a few people, do you think he'll do it?
Well, if there was a sincere desire to stop torture, then it would have stopped. There would be no defense of those who ordered torture. There would be no effort on the part of the Obama administration to hide any aspect of U.S. operations that engaged in torture, that were a party to torture. And in fact, the Obama administration would be actively prosecuting those who made such orders. We have seen the international litigation with respect to torture that was started against the former president of Chile, Pinochet. Yeah. And that was done by the wonderful judge Garzón in Spain. And in fact, the United Nations Special Rapporteur for Torture made a statement on U.S. television that the United Nations has the goods on the United States. And at least one very well-respected international attorney in the United States has said that Obama risks becoming an accessory mm-hmm. if he does not prosecute those who, at least investigate and then prosecute those who are guilty of torture. So we've got to see, I believe, some motions going into, but I have honestly more faith in what Judge Garzón is prepared to do in Spain than what I've seen so far generated by the Obama White House with respect to what they have done so far on torture, rendition. In fact, if there was Guantanamo would not only be closed right now, but it would have been handed over to the Cuban people.
Yeah, absolutely. Cynthia, let's move on to another topic. I have two that I want to bring up. One is your visit to Palestine. I want to get on to that next. But the first one I want to start off was, where were you physically on the day of 9/11?
Physically, I was in Washington, D.C., and I was preparing to go into the Congress. The Congress convenes at 10 o'clock every morning, and so I was preparing to go to Congress. I was preparing to go to work. And I had the television on, and I was watching as most people were, and all of a sudden I couldn't believe what was happening. And the State Department was being evacuated, and we honestly were waiting for instructions as to where to report. And I think eventually I went to the Congress that day, and we met on the steps of the Capitol, I believe. But, yeah, I was in Washington, D.C. on that day.
Some stuff I found out about what your early statements. You were apparently reported as saying that as on the of the day of 9/11, where maybe on the you're talking about on the steps here, or at least on the day of 9/11, you were given some talking points, and some of the talking points you found kind of strange were they attacked us because we're free and they hate us because we're you know we're a democracy and stuff like that. Is that correct?
Yes, the talking points were distributed to us at various points throughout that entire period. And it was always interesting, you know, who wrote them. But if you recall, you could hear members of Congress going back into their local constituencies with this message. There was a national message that was delivered, and that message was they hate us because we're free. Well, now, you know, being a black American, I understand, and we just finished this discussion about the counterintelligence program. So, you know, I expect a little bit more from a defense and an intelligence establishment and to which trillions of U.S. taxpayer dollars have been invested. And so now you're going to tell me that the Pentagon, which is charged with power projection around the world, couldn't protect itself? That is an incredible set of circumstances for me that just cried out for an investigation, and yet we had the Bush administration saying, no, we don't want to investigate. We had George Bush and we had Dick Cheney, the vice president, actively lobbying against any kind of investigation as to what happened that day. And of course, you have investigations for everything. When a train wrecks, you have an investigation. When a plane crashes, you have an investigation. And you're not going to have an investigation when a tragedy of this resort takes place. And then you're going to say to the family members of the victims that they can't sue. They cannot engage in a legal action if they take money from this, you know, victims' compensation fund. So the last bill that I dropped in when I left in 2003 after the 2002 election was to allow the 911 victims to be able to sue as well as participate in the victims' compensation fund. And then if we looked at followed the money and then began to look at how this victims' compensation funds were expended, it was, you know, and who was in charge, and it was just very clear that the American people weren't being told the truth, and that the, I think they later called it a failure of imagination because Condoleezza Rice, among others, said, well, they just couldn't imagine that this was going to happen. You know, there's a failure of imagination. Well, you don't spend trillions of dollars for people to fail to have an imagination about how the United States can be attacked. But it's even more than that, you know, and so we still haven't been told the truth. Well, I understand that, and I think a growing number of people understand that the American people haven't been told the truth. We were promised a white paper. There was, I think, about 50 paragraphs that was produced, not by the United States. Colin Powell was the one who said we were going to get the white paper, never got the white paper. Tony Blair produced about 50 paragraphs, and then at the end of it, it said that this is not a document that is able to stand up in court. So, you know, what? And then I went to DOJ.gov, and you go there, and Osama bin Laden is not even wanted for September 11th, according to the FBI. And so now what exactly is going on? And yet, if you know the relationship of previous administrations with the Bin Laden family, it just begs for independent investigation. And that's why I support the New York ballot initiative to establish an independent international investigation. We've got people from all over the world now who are saying that they can't believe, I mean, elected officials from all over the world and former elected officials saying that they can't believe the narrative.
Yeah, it doesn't, and they never explained Building 7. The Patriot Act, were you present for its signing or did you vote on it?
I was present for the vote. I voted against it, of course.
One of very few.
That's right. But the Patriot Act just smacked of, and everything that came after that, really.
Congresswoman, I mean, we're talking about the day of 9/11. Now, I always ask people, now, there's one guy in the last couple of years that I've been doing radio, I've asked him, where were you on 9/11? And he said, oh, I don't remember. I find that, you know, most people, you know, they know when you know, other Diana died, and you know, they know where, you know, where John F. Kennedy was assassinated. They know my mom remembers exactly where she was. Now, so we're going from the morning.
Who was that? Who was that that doesn't remember where they were on September 11th?
I'm trying to remember who. I've interviewed the person, and maybe one of my listeners will remind me who. I just can't put a name to it, but one person said to me in an interview he couldn't remember where he was physically on 9/11, and it made me suspicious. I'll have to look into it and see who that was. So, I mean, you're going through the day of 9/11, very little information, and then later on, late evening, early morning, you're presented a 572-page document that is, you know, prepared well in advance, based on certain manipulations and certain directions of Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, what were the other congressmen saying? I mean, they hand you out a bill, said they signed this, we need to protect ourselves. I mean, physically, you were there. It's not very often that I'll get to talk to somebody who was actually physically there. I mean, what was the emotion? I mean, what were you told? Were you told, sign this, you better sign it quick, and, you know, what actually happened during the few minutes or hours concerning the passage of the Patriot Act?
Well, you have to understand that there's a ready-made sort of an existing voting bloc that is ready to implement this kind of stuff based on this idea of security or whatever at a moment's notice anyway. And, you know, it's the get tough with the criminals kind of mentality, which I attribute to, you know, this the testosterone laden aspect of you know, get ready to bomb people and that kind of thing, and so people go along with that, and there's this very conservative people, and then you have some people who were afraid and they really didn't know what was going on and they didn't have any information and they voted from fear, which I understand now is a tactic.
Yeah.
To make people afraid, and then you would submit to things that your rational self would not otherwise even contemplate or allow submission to. So this is a part of what happens, and we have to have the kind of experienced people, and this is why, you know, even though I started out talking about the problems, the personal sacrifices that people like me are asked to endure, but at the same time, I understand that there are only few people to whom the whole way things operate has been unveiled. And if you've been given the opportunity to have certain information, what is the best way in order to act upon that information within your capabilities. I was raised with the understanding that people ought to assume the highest level of contribution to the common good. Mm-hmm. And so if I were to go back into Congress now, I know infinitely more about the value of the seat, about the forces that are arrayed against such a reentry. I know how to operate inside the system so as to maximize the leverage of that seat for people who generally are marginalized and left out and alienated and lied to, and all the forces of division, the balkanization of the American electorate, so as to allow a smaller group of people to eventually control the politics of the whole, the economic situation that is being visited upon the American people today, and how some people can make pronouncements about, well, this is of the scale of the Soviet Union. Well, we know what happened with the Soviet Union under Yeltsin and the ushering in of the state of Russia. Under Gorbachev and the ushering in of the state of Russia as a new political entity on the global stage with Yeltsin, and the creation of the oligarchs, and what is actually happening now, and who's in charge of the economic program of the United States, and the role that they had to play in the creation of these oligarchs on the Russian side and now on the U.S. side. So we have a lot that we need to inform people of, so that I don't know if your audience would be familiar with a series Star Trek, and I fancy myself a Trekkie, and there was one episode in particular where the generals engaged in war, and they were in spaceships up above the planet, but the people on the planet had to pay the price, and the war was actually a game. And one general would say, okay, I've got to do this, and it results in 10,000 people dead, and so they would march the people, and the people would willingly be marched to the incinerators because the general said 10,000 people. The game said that 10,000 people were dying. Well, you know, honestly, we can't willingly march ourselves to the incinerators. We should not be expected to do that. And our national leadership should be protecting us and protecting the global community. And that includes also protecting our planet and the life of the planet so that we can have human life as well.
Absolutely. I'll get back. I want, there's an incident. You first came up on my radar, Congresswoman, with a couple of videos that you actually, and I said, wow, this is a gutsy woman. You tried to get legislation to prosecute Bush, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice for 9/11, and I said, wow, this is one gutsy woman. When, I just want to get back and stick on this for a moment, is the 9/11, you know, the different things that have happened since 9/11. To point to, you were very, very vocal, very, very early on, that the U.S. government and including George Bush were aware prior to 9/11 of the attacks, and you were very, very vocal, trying to find out, what did Bush know and the rest of them know and whatever. And one of the things that sticks out in my mind is this guy, General Mahmoud Ahmad, who arrived, who was head of the Pakistani ISI, who during the summer of 2001 made a very, easily traceable $100,000 transfer to Atta, who was apparently the lead hijacker on 9/11, but that was in custody. This guy that had been out on boat trips with Jack Abramoff and whatever. And this guy arrived in New York on the 4th of September 2001, and during the week before, you know, prior to 9/11, he had meetings with the likes of George Tenet, who was the head of the CIA. He met up with the future guy, Porter Goss, John Kyle, John Kerry, Joe Biden came up. I didn't know he had met Joe Biden, which he has. And this question of the transfer, you look into it a little bit more, and then you say, why didn't the 9/11 Commission really look into it instead of giving their little fable answer of, it's only a small amount of money? Now, this guy, from my research, Congresswoman, as head of the Pakistani ISI, which is, you know, just an umbrella for CIA and Mossad, that this guy worked very closely with the Osama bin Laden terrorist group known as Al-Qaeda, and that some of these Porter Goss and Graham, Senator Graham, were actually prior to 9/11 in Pakistan. And met up with the general. For me, it looks like in preparation for creating a legend, if you understand that expression, to create a legend of the 19 Arab terrorists.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of unanswered questions, and the family members themselves whose family members were victims, direct victims,
absolutely,
of the tragedies have unanswered questions. And there are a lot of things that, you know, like, for example, I think that these covert activities that the United States is engaged in should not be covert. And in fact, I would argue that we don't need to engage in this kind of behavior. The American people ought to know what their government is doing, and they ought to know what's being done with their money. And there should be nothing that is held away from the people. But this allows for the very kind of activity that I can tell you I know about because of the availability of the documents, and that's Operation Northwoods, where the Joint Chiefs of Staff sat around a table and decided on how they could wreak terror inside the United States so they could engage in a war against Castro's Cuba.
Absolutely.
And they openly discussed blowing up
civilian aircraft.
Civilian aircraft carrying university students away from school on holiday so that they could get more sympathy from the American people. This is something that was discussed. We, as a black person, I can look at MK Ultra and Paul Robeson, one of the most esteemed persons globally, and yet there was this, he was victimized by this mind control program of the CIA. We still don't know everything that happened with that. His family sued the United States government. I think the case was thrown out. What happened with that kind of research and, you know, the drug trafficking? We know about the reportage of Geary Webb and the whole Iran-Contra. And one aspect of that was that black families all over the United States were penetrated with this drug that didn't even exist before the United States decided that they wanted to finance their operation in Central America to protect the dictators and make sure that the Sandinistas of Daniel Ortega didn't win. Now, Daniel Ortega, interestingly, is president of Nicaragua once again. It ultimately failed, but in the process, there were millions of black people, including people in my family, who to this day remain drug addicts because of this policy. These kinds of activities carried on by the United States government must stop and need to be known by the American people. If they're known, they will stop.
Well, I was reading sent in a local newspaper about 2 weeks ago here in Geneva, Switzerland, that the number of heroin addicts has tripled in 3 years. I mean, the drugs, the Taliban nearly had the entire poppy harvest eradicated before the Northern Alliance leader got assassinated, which I find links again to the Pakistani ISI and back to the general. You know, the heroin is still on the streets, and that's coming from Afghanistan. You know, and we're going to be sending more soldiers. Australia is going to send more soldiers. The puppets in the UK are going to send more soldiers. Obama is going to send more soldiers. It seems to me that they're there to basically make sure that there's no breakage in the supply of drugs to the rest of the youngsters of the world, that they're going to be infected with this sickness of heroin and cocaine, and they have, you know, multiple sources now, and they have multiple drugs. If it's ecstasy coming in from Israel, they have cocaine, heroin, and whatever. They're talking about legalizing cannabis in California. They claim it's a $14 billion crop, and they want to tax it. They want some of the money. I mean, our young people, Cynthia, are severely under attack via these political Zionistic attitudes towards the rest of the world, that there is no humanity to these people. And especially this is, you know, obvious when we apply this to Washington. And I think you've said it yourself, you've 1%, if we're lucky, of honest American politicians actually fighting for the American people that they're supposed to be representing. And we have this overall infection of control by external sources, and by, you know, you can call them lobbyists and special interests. But I mean, these people do have names. Now, I'd like to get back to this guy. You know, one of the reasons this general now is back in Pakistan making millions and millions off his agricultural scams. But this guy, I mean, was having breakfast on 9/11 with Porter Goss and several of the top cronies. And this doesn't get in. Now, as I said, I followed the research, and you go down, and the people that were that selected what was going to be on the 9/11. What did you make of the 9/11 Commission besides the disgust? But the amount of information that was sent there was very, very filtered. You've already said that Bush and Cheney were calling around saying, no, we don't want an investigation. So basically, we had a whitewash. So here we are, I think, you know, looking on 8 years later. Listen, Congresswoman, listen, it's been a thrill to have you on. You're a great, great source of information. I know your time is you've given me a little bit more than you promised that you could allocate me, and I know you're a very, very busy woman. Listen, I'd love to have you on again and get into you know, these topics, and a few specifically you getting rammed by the Israeli Navy, but I can wait for another time. I'll give you the last word, Congresswoman, it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. And the reason I got into trouble in 2002 for talking about what happened on September 11th was because one of the newspapers that I relied on was an Irish newspaper. And in fact, I relied on newspapers in Australia, Ireland, Scotland, various European newspapers and Israeli newspapers that were giving more information than were the U.S. newspapers. And that's how I knew that this series of warnings had come in, and that's why I asked the question, what did the Bush administration know and when did it know it? But I think that a descendant of enslaved Africans in the United States is not supposed to ask such a question.
Thank you very much, Congresswoman. This is best of luck with the book. Talk to you very soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So that was the good Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. Listen, that was a pleasure. I think we did about 70 minutes. Didn't get around to cover all the topics I wanted to get into, to finance and Geithner and all these other I consider criminals. So maybe wait for part two. maybe try the congresswoman in a couple of weeks and we do part two. So this is Augner for TIU Radio, theinfounderground.com. Back soon, keeping up the work. Time is against us, and especially now after that little conversation, 99% of the US politicians are working against the American people. I think that says enough about the situation that our brothers and sisters of all religions and all colours in the United States are under an absolute onslaught, and I reckon if we went back, that hasn't changed much since the International Jewish Bankers took over the money system in 1913, implemented the IRS, B'nai B'rith, the ADL, the Tavistock Institute in London, 1913. Anyway, Oxford, I'll be back soon.